So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, friends, students, and our esteemed guests. My name is Ellen Aitken, and it's my honor to serve as Dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies here at McGill. It's also my privilege to welcome you all here this afternoon and to moderate this public discussion, Rethinking Secularism, with two distinguished scholars, Charles Taylor and Jose Casanova, scholars who are at the forefront of the cultural and intellectual project of rethinking and reimagining secularism. I'm delighted to tell you that this conversation is jointly sponsored by the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism in McGill's Faculty of Law and by the Faculty of Religious Studies as a dimension of our Religion and Globalization Initiative. The conversation is being streamed live and will be available afterwards also as a video podcast on the Faculty of Religious Studies website. I want also to welcome those of you viewing this from afar, especially our colleagues and the students at our partner universities in the Faith and Globalization Network within the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. So before I introduce our guests, a word about the format of this afternoon. We'll begin with Professors Taylor and Casanova presenting in a nutshell their ideas on the topic, especially out of their contributions to the volume Rethinking Secularism, which is edited by Craig Calhoun, Mark Jurgensmeyer, and Jonathan van Antwerpen, and published this fall by Oxford University Press. We'll then turn, after about 30 minutes or so, to questions that will be put to Professors Taylor and Casanova from a small panel of students who are keenly interested in these topics. Sarah Brager, who's doing a BA Honors in Religious Studies and a minor in Russian Studies. Tashuf Kara, who's doing a BA Honors in International Development Studies and a minor in Environment. And Elvira Vichuskanskaya, she'll say it better than I do, who's beginning an MA in philosophy of religion. And after that, which will go for another 30 minutes or so, for the remainder of the time, we'll open up the floor to all of you for your questions before concluding at about 5 p.m. It is now my pleasure to introduce our speakers. Professor Charles Taylor scarcely needs an introduction to a McGill or Montreal audience. Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Philosophy at McGill, a scholar of cultural identity, pluralism, modernity, and multiculturalism, he is the author of numerous books, including Varieties of Religion Today, Multiculturalism, Examining the Politics of Recognition, and most recently, A Secular Age. He has served as the co-chair of the Quebec Consultation Commission on Accommodation Practices Related to Cultural Differences, the Reasonable Accommodation Commission, and received in 2007 the Templeton Prize, which sits among his many other honors. Professor Jose Casanova is one of the world's leading scholars in the sociology of religion and globalization. He is a professor at the Department of Sociology and at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And he heads the Berkeley Center's program on globalization, religion, and the secular. He has published works in a broad range of subjects, including transnational religions, global religious denominationalism, religion and globalization, migration and religious pluralism, secularization, and sociological theory. His best-known work, Public Religions in the Modern World, in 1994, has become a modern classic in the field and has been translated into five languages, including Arabic and Indonesian. His research has focused heavily on the public impact of global Catholicism, and he is deeply concerned with the evolving role of religion in modern culture. And so to open up this conversation, I would like each of you, and we'll begin with Professor Taylor, to begin by saying something about how you think we need to think about the secular today, particularly both in our local context and as that local context is shaped by and contributes to the shaping of the global. I'll pose some general questions and then let you take these wherever you want. So what approaches can be used for positioning the arena that we call religion or religions within or in relation to the secular? What are the social imaginaries with which we work in thinking about the secular and religion and pluralism? And what do you find are the central problems with the social imaginaries with which we live and work? And what suggestions would you make for the project of revisiting the dominant modes of secularism in the public sphere? Thank you.
Well, a few simple questions, maybe we'll more need. We'll need several years. But, yeah, let's start off with the approaches issue, how to approach it. Well, I tried in my book, I'm going to repeat some of that, to say that our understanding of secularism in the West is really predicated on two main ideas of what the developments have been, and I wanted to add a third, and I think that's the important one to add. One is that we see secularization as the gradual separation of religion from the state, the public sphere. Sometimes people talk about separation from politics, but certainly from the public sphere. Something like the separation of church and state, something like that happens even in countries that have established churches, like the Church of England, or not Sweden anymore, but the Church of Denmark, Church of Norway. Something like that has happened. The second thing people speak of is the decline in religious faith and or practice. Sometimes these less in faith than in practice and so on, but these are considered to be the two main lines of development which people have thought of as secularization in the West. And to that, I wanted to add a third one, which I think is in some ways more interesting. And that is, it's hard to define it exactly, what are the conditions of belief today? If people are hesitating between belief and unbelief, or between this religious view and that religious view, or whatever, in our day to now in the West, what is the kind of background in which those kinds of reflections are going on? The background which we take for granted, but which makes a big difference when it comes to people working this kind of thing out. I mean, just contrast certain situations where it's, let's say, a majority Muslim country and the idea of dropping Islam is could be, you know, they put you in a lot of trouble, let's put it that way, on one hand. And people who are self-defined searchers, spiritual but not religious in our society, who are kind of floating around looking for, finding a road. There's a very, very different surrounding, very different understanding of the place of religion in the whole society, very different understanding of what the options are that exist in our society. Now, this third question, it's important because I think it gets to the point where, if you like, the whole development we call secularization really impinges on people's lives and makes an important difference to their lives. It's also important because, unlike the other two developments, it really is, I think, universal throughout the West. That is, the other two developments being separation of church and state, which is pretty general, but is in very different forms, as you can see, if we do look rapidly around. And certainly the second development, the supposed retreat of religious faith and practice, which is really tremendously different if you look all the way from the United States on one end to ex-DDR East Germany on the other, where there's a majority of atheists. You have just about every possibility in between, right? So that there isn't something absolutely general. There isn't a kind of general type of decline. But when you look at this third feature, I think you do get to something that is general to the West. So just mention a couple of factors about that, a couple of features about that. How am I doing it? But tell me when I get to it, because it could go on and on. Yeah. So there are a couple of factors about that. One is the way in which religion has become, this is something that goes back a century or so, but it's become very often heavily involved as a marker of political mobilization, right? Even certain confessions are kind of markers of certain national identity, like think of the Polish resistance to communism and so on. The second very important development, and doesn't fit easily with this first one, is the tremendous spread of what I would call religious seekers, searchers, people who are think of themselves as moving along a spiritual path. And this is something which is not only helped by a tremendous religious fragmentation, that is, people spread out new views that weren't around before, both religious and non-religious, but also itself accelerates that fragmentation. I call the Nova effect in the book. And it's very linked to a powerful cultural change, which is part of modern 20th century, late 20th century Western history, which is the development of what I want to call the ethic of authenticity, the idea that each human being has their own way of being human. They have to find that, follow it, rather than accept conformity from the society around them or the last generation or whatever is seen as the threat of imposed conformity. So that is a very important thing to explore and understand, and we don't, that's where we need another kind of operation with concepts like social imaginary. We're trying to understand how people themselves understand. But it also is a point at which we immediately see that the whole theory about secularization that I've been just pointing to is really very Western and doesn't necessarily apply in other very, you know, important parts of the world, in China and India and Islamic society. And I think that we make terrible mistake. I mean, we make kind of big confusion and ethnocentrism and so on in thinking, not only thinking of secularization as a single development instead of these three, but thinking of it as something that could happen anywhere, has happened here first, will happen, is happening slightly behind elsewhere, will happen at other places. If you look, we can talk about this later, if you look at a society like China, the whole concept secular doesn't fit. You know, the whole set of underlying contrasts that define it just don't fit. And you try to cram it into that hole, and people do. I mean, the trouble is we've sort of got a globalized acceptance of categories, but when you look at how they're applied, I mean, Jose can talk about this. Religion in China doesn't include Confucianism. Ah, it's not religion. Well, just a minute. No. How exactly is this term being defined? You can see that there's some really extreme lack of fit. So we need not only sensitive understanding of social imaginaries in the different countries of the West in order to understand our development, but we need this sense of the contrast between these and the social imaginaries that have developed in other parts of the world in order to break down this very simple conception of secularization. I mean, just grosso modo to sum it all up, the notion of secularization about 40 years ago was tremendously oversimplified as a single development, really mainly consisting of the decline of religious faith and practice and the separation of church and state. And it's much more complex than that. And it's much more complex because it involves changes in self-understanding of societies. And it's much more complex, again, because these changes are utterly different, have to be tackled and understood in utterly different terms when you move from the Western case to the Indian case to the Chinese case to the Islamic case to various African societies and so on. We have a huge field before us that requires more sensitive comparative work and de-ethnocentrization, whatever the word is, of Western social theory. Where am I at?
5 minutes.
A minute, yeah. So, I mean, five more. Okay. And that leads us to another whole set of areas which I talked about secularization. That's the process that's gone on, how to understand the process that's gone on. But we also have what people call secularism, which is part of the development I roughly gestured at with the separation of church and state. That is the attempt to build regimes, law regimes, which religion has a certain place in society and there's certain rights and duties and so on connected to it. And it's called, of course, here, laïcité. These words, incidentally, are, as you know, they aren't translations, but they're sort of functional equivalents. That is, if you're thrashing out some of these issues in a French-speaking or Italian-speaking or Turkish-speaking society. You'll use la cité, la città, la clique, and if you're thrashing out these issues in an Anglophone society or in German society, you'll use secular, secular, and so on. So there, but there are slight differences. But I think we are facing a series of very, very big choices on this because the tremendous pluralization of the religious scene in all Western societies, partly due to immigration, but partly also due to people taking up new positions. Some people that are totally in their background, Western and so on, take on a Hindu or a Buddhist orientation or something of that kind. So, but anyway, the tremendous pluralization of religions has made earlier models, now I'll say laïcité because we're here, we've had a fight about that and we're going to have a fight, even more of a fight about that in the future, have made certain models of laïcité historically dominant, which were predicated on the idea that there was a single great threatening dominant religion, Catholic Church here, if you want to know, yeah, right? Are just completely out of phase. They're not connecting with a society where there is no one big threatening religion, where there is a tremendous number of religions, some of them held by people of relatively less clout in the society because they're recent immigrants, and the issue is how do these coexist in a way which is fair, equitable, consistent with a democratic society. And these orientations are very much up for grabs, as you saw not just in the commission, that Jacques and I were involved in, but in the discussion since the commission and the return of certain very strong, laïcité ouverte contre laïcité fermée. This is the way it's... But something like this is happening in Germany, in Denmark, UK, in a tremendous number of Western societies. So we have these two dimensions, if you like, the historical, explanatory, and the normative, legal, but they can't be understood without some kind of contact with each other. It's understanding what's happened that allows us to argue and discuss, I think, clearly and with some kind of clairvoyance about what we ought to do about our secularist or laic regimes. Well, in a nutshell, is that about... Okay, that's...
Let me draw a slightly different distinction between two types of secularism and why both types are being rethought or we need to rethink them today, and it's happening everywhere. So why do we find ourselves in this situation? I say slightly different because basically the problem between Charles and me is we agree practically on everything and there can never be a serious debate. let's try to... Two types of secularism. One, what could be called a philosophy of history. Some theory about some genealogical theory of how religion started, and some theory of development that usually is a theory of secularization, and then some theory of the telos somehow that religion is either going to disappear or become increasingly irrelevant. This was, of course, a view that permeated much of Western thought since the Enlightenment, and has to be rethought not because it is not a narrative which makes sense. It makes sense the way Charles has rewritten this narrative from 1500 to the present. It's a particularly Western, Christian, European history, or a North Atlantic history, but then we Westerners have said, no, this is a universal history of human development. So this, which has happened, this transformation in the West, is only the end of a process that began at the beginning of human history, and this is the culmination of universal human history. And then is where the problem starts. Because there is no doubt that this story, these transformations, this secularization has taken place. And of course, it's not only a particular Western history, because of Western colonial expansion, it has become part of global history. So this model, what Charles calls the immanent frame, has become globalized now. The whole world is, in this respect, secular. But within this same global secular world, the phenomenological experiences of what this transformation means is radically different. We see even how different this transformation is taken in Western secular Europe and in religious North America, let's say the United States. When it comes to other parts of the world, then it's obvious that these same transformations are very different. We associate, ultimately, this is an idea that we are beyond religion, that religion is something of the past, and that we have liberated ourselves from religion, we are emancipated from religion, we are free from religion. We understand this process as a process of freeing ourselves from something in the past. This is a kind of a phenomenological experience which is very, very strong in Europe. Elsewhere, this experience of modernization is actually understood as an experience of, for the first time, becoming religious in some way. So people, the more modern they become, the more religious they become. Not in our sense of religious, but identity of being Hindus or being Muslims grow with modernization rather than diminish. And so we are simply caught in a very difficult situation. Because then, because we understand this religion is something of the past that we have overcome, it means that these people that are becoming religious are not of our age. Somehow they're still in the past. So the question is, as long as we maintain this kind of stadial consciousness, we have gone through these stages of development, and they have not gone through these stages yet. And this is part of these global encounters that make very difficult to understand how we are coming together in this global world. So this is the aspect of the idea of secularism and how we got where we are. The second form of secularism is more a kind of a statecraft doctrine, some kind of ways of separating, we call it church and state. Of course, this is a particular Christian principle. There are no churches in any other religion. So it has to be called something else. And I think that Alfred Stepan, the political scientist, has developed this notion of the twin separations. The need to have some kind of separation between political authority and religious authority in order to have democratic societies. But of course the question is which kind of separations? And then we understood the secularism as one single formula valid for all countries. But if we look in the West itself, laïcité is a very different model of separation than the wall of separation in the United States, which is a very strict, more strict separation than in France. But there is no separation of religion and politics. So you have a legal, constitutional separation, no establishment, but the free exercise of religion precisely means that religion and politics are always together. And if you see this model, and then we see how laïcité travel from France to Turkey, and laïc in Turkey is radically different, because there it means that the Turkish state is a secular state that incorporates Islam, makes it a state religion that controls and regulates what Islam is. And is basically a kind of a Caesar or Papist control of Islam in Turkey. And then you go to Senegal, a French colony, which also uses laïcité. But there is a model much closer to the American one, in which basically, yes, we need laïcité so that precisely the different forms of Islam can live together, and no single form of Orthodox Islam oppresses the other forms of Islam. So for the sake of internal pluralism within Islam, the Senegalese want to have laïcité. And then you go to Indonesia, and again you have a form of secularism, but again very different from the Senegal one. So you see, and in India, Indian secularism is different from the French, from the American, and China, of course, is very different. So the point is we realize that we all use the word secular and secular states, and we think that we know what it means, but of course we are misunderstanding each other. So once we are realized the fact that there are so many different forms of secularism, no formula is valid for everywhere in all the cultures. And so it implies a recognition that we are now all confronting the fact that our particular form of secularism is a very unique, particular one that is maybe good for this place, but would not work somewhere else. And the recognition there is no single formula that can be applied, there is no best formula. There is no way that the French are going to adopt the American model as much as the Americans would like to export their model, or vice versa. And so what we have to do is to come to terms reflexively with the very many different forms of secularism that we have around the world. And what is interesting is how all of them are being put into question today. So you have this kind of debates about the secularism taking place in China today, taking place in India, taking place in Indonesia. And so this is what is interesting, that it is really a global issue of how we all are thinking of the relation between politics and whatever we call religion. I think I'll stop there, and there we go.
We'll turn now to questions from the students. And we'll start with Sarah, shall we? No, with Elvira. Okay.
Hi.
Wait a sec. Good.
Hi, so both of you have spoken about the possibility of giving a historical narrative of the process of secularization as it occurred in the Western Christian world. And the question here is, can we really speak of a Western Christian experience given that this experience itself has been ever-changing and evolving, namely because of Western encounters with non-Christian religious traditions? Thank you.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, it's not just, of course, the difference has not just been because of encounters, although those have been important, but they've been breaks within. I mean, we had Reformation, and then we had further reform and so on. But I think you can defend the idea that Latin Christendom, the entity which already had a very clear boundary in, let's say, 1,000, started on a certain path not long after that, particularly with the Hildebrandine reform, with the, you know, the investiture controversy. And it started on a particular direction of change, which brought it farther and farther away from other Christendoms. I mean, from, for instance, Eastern Christendom. I mean, it's maybe a coincidence, but it's not entirely a coincidence that the break between Roman Constantinople, which we generally date the last one, 1054, right, is really just a few decades before, a couple of decades before the Hildebrandine reform, which really altered very, very seriously the whole understanding of the place of the church in the society. And it even gives us something like the notion of a use of the term secular versus the opposite, related to eternity or spiritual and so on, which was very much part of the language of late medieval Christendom, of Latin Christendom. And so I think there are certain very important benchmarks laid down which do give this a kind of contour in which it makes sense. And when you jump out of that, even to other Christendoms, I mean, let's say the Greek one, but also the Syriac and so on, you get totally different understanding of what's going on.
Two points. One is that the internal divisions within even Western Christendom, namely the Protestant Reformation, obviously incorporates a radical separation, which can be brought perhaps the most radically between the model of laicite and the model of Anglo-Saxon secularism. If we understand secularization as an attempt to mediate, bridge what had been the religious secular wall, the monastery and the world, and try to somehow revaluate the seculum, the world, and make it somehow worthy, you know, basically human flourishing itself, then you have two ways of doing it. The Protestant northern way is to break the walls and bring the monks to the world so that everybody becomes a monk. And the religious secular become mixed and blur. It's very much in the United States. You don't never know where religion begins and the secular ends. They are so interconnected. Versus the mother of laicite, that means, yes, you keep the boundaries very clear. You simply push the religion into the margins and you open up a sphere of laicite, free from religion. Those are two, even within the West, two very different models. And then, of course, when you go elsewhere, as you point out, the colonial encounter, it was through the colonial encounter that precisely the West became so aware of those things. But it's interesting, I'm working now on the Jesuits and globalization in the 16th century. And it's interesting because the Jesuits at the time do not have yet the sense that we are superior economically, politically, civilizationally. We are superior, our religion is. But they go and they become Brahmins in India, Mandarins in China, slave owners in Maryland, indigenous in Paraguay. So they have a model of going native and trying to make Christianity, not make our people Western Christian, but to make Christianity beyond the West. So there are different ways in which these encounters have taken place at different times. Then comes Orientalism later. And then comes, of course, the idea of Western universalism. So, but yes, those stories are very much, I would say, linked together. Yes.
Thank you. The second question is, it's often assumed that the religious secular divide, as you have spoken about, is analogous to the sacred and profane. And so the question is, can the religious be profane while the secular also be sacred? Thank you.
I think that they are very close together, but the thing is that they are very, these are very sort of vague and general categories. If you go back to the heart of the secular versus whatever the opposition is, it's to do with understandings of human beings in time. Right? So there's an understanding of the world in which we live as passing through what we normally think of as profane time or secular time, one moment after another, etc., one damn thing after another, as Henry Ford defined history. You know? And the same society has to be seen as related to the eternal in a long sweep of the Heilsgeschichte, of the history of salvation. And where you're looking at its relation to the eternal, then you're not in the secular. So you have words like spiritual or eternal and so on. Where you're looking at it from the standpoint of just what happens from day to day, then it's the secular. And I think that this has led to this kind of rich concept of what secular life is like, which is the one that Jose was talking about. Well, in either case, I mean, either if the enrichment is because it's sort of there's no more boundary between the higher and the lower, or if the enrichment is because you want to push religion to the margins and have a humanistically enriched secular life. This notion is much more powerful in Western history and is foreign people's consciousness, much more than, let's say, profane. See? So you have Durkheim coming in with saying the really big opposition is sacred versus profane, and then he redefines the sacred that it can include the rights of man in the Third Republic. Right? So it's something which then feeds into this very enriched notion of secular life, but it's obviously a very different kind of opposition. So it's really worthwhile looking at the fine print of these.
Here I would argue that we use, and interchangeably, but we have to be careful because they're very different, sacred, profane, transcendent, mundane, and religious, secular. I mean, this gets us to the ideas of the Axial Age and what the Axial Age, the bringing of transcendence, or at least the possibility of looking at the world for the first time as something mundane, which from an outside perspective, as opposed to the notion of an immanent world where gods and humans and nature is all part of one precisely single world. So this dualism of the mundane and how the mundane then is considered is, of course, a key issue. And to a certain extent, modern secularity is an attempt to reevaluate the mundane as the place of human flourishing. But then, of course, the mundane, which then gets to the notion of cosmos and nomos and law and all these kind of things, becomes very different in Indian culture, in Chinese culture. So these are the two. And then the third is when the modern secular religious, in which it is the secular state and the secular spheres, which are the dominant ones, and then religion becomes its own separate differentiated sphere. And then, of course, the question is, you could say that actually it's a way of, if for Durkheim the sacred was the collective public and the profane was actually private, you could say that in modernity secularization means making religion profane, making the secular the public relevant arena. One could put it this way. So you have the sacred nation, you have sacred citizenship, sacred human rights. So you have a process of sacralization, which is parallel to the process of secularization of religion. But this model then, when it becomes globalized, so we are in a process of sacralization of human rights. At the same time, you have religious revivals of all kinds of traditional religions. And then you have, in our immanent frame, the possibility of having all religions, the most primitive, the most axial, and the most postmodern together in global cities. And all of them living, being there, available for any individual to appropriate as their own religion. And then we use the category of religion for all kinds of things. Religious nationalism, civil religion, all kinds of magic, all kinds of spiritual search, and everything is religion. And it's not that nothing is religion. So we are caught in, precisely because all these categories do not fit very, very well.
Thank you. One last question from me is, how does the very possibility of providing this historical narrative about our secular age in the West, how does that presuppose that we've reached the beginning of a post-secular time, and what does that time look like for both of you? Thank you.
I wonder what the word post-secular means. You see, that maybe what it really ends up meaning is when people stop believing in that very simple story of secularism as an inevitable movement which, you know, is pushing religion away, when social scientists and philosophers really took on board that that doesn't work anymore, we entered in another sense a post-secular age. But it's not because the things on the ground changed. It's because the frame in which intellectuals and others see this changed. And I don't actually knock, that's not unimportant. That's unimportant, but it's not a change. It's not as though secularization happened and now we jumped into another age. See, the way people use postmodern, which I think is equally, equally confused, that the modern age and then we put all that behind us and we go postmodern. If you think of post-secular on the model of that, it's just not what, it corresponds to nothing in reality, I think.
As you know, it was Habermas who, in Europe, made the word post-secular, the post-secular society. And, of course, Habermas was the great theorist of secular modernity. So what does he mean? Obviously, not so much that we are religious again, but that we are reflexively no longer secularist. So post-secular here can only mean reflexive post-secularism. So we are still secular, but we are reflexively secular in which our own secularity is not understood as the universal final stadial age of humanity. And also a form of the secular, which I think will be good to go back even to Augustine, when he saw the secular at this time between now and the parousia, the second coming, in which pagans and Christians have to live together and work together for the civic common good. So the notion of precisely this common sphere in which different forms of life, different, very different ideas, people have to simply live together and work towards some common good, which cannot be defined in terms of any particular religion or any particular ideology. And in this respect, this would mean that post-secular would mean simply one secularity, which is not anymore the secular after the religious, but the secular, which is this neutral sphere where all religions and all ideologies simply come together and recognize each other as part of a common life.
My question refers to Professor Taylor's book, but it's open to both of you. According to Professor Taylor in his book, A Secular Age, religion in the West has gone from having a community mentality to having a partisan stance. Does this mean that religion has become almost completely private and personal in the West? And if so, can the term religion still be used, or do we need to find a new term for a new sociocultural phenomenon?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't quite recognize what I was saying in that, because I think I do. I think I do. But let me try see if I've got it. I mean, that religion in the West has always been also a matter of communities, I mean, churches and so on. It also is still, as I said, in these cases where confession, for instance, becomes a marker of a national identity, it becomes something which is common, lived collectively by the nation. Alongside that, however, we have the growth of a phenomenon which, you know, a tremendous growth of a phenomenon, of people who are searching. And in that case, you're getting very often an individuation of religion. Now, this is it's more complex because people who search may find the direction of search by joining some church, right? But they may not, or it may simply be some movement for meditation or something of that kind. So I think perhaps the most useful way of seeing what's happening here would be the following, that 300 years ago, a bit more than that, and reaching back, we had phenomena we can identify as religious communities and churches and so on, in which a lot of things were going on together. That is, I mean, among other things, holding the society together by certain ethos and so on and so on. But also, there were within those religious communities people who were searching for a more vibrant, full relation to God. We think of all the mystics, the people who founded religious orders and so on. These were held within these overarching religious communities. Today, a great many searchers are totally disconnected from these modes of collective religious life. There's a separating out which is happening. Now, to get to the last line quickly of your question, all of this is religion, which means that if anybody uses the word, starts a sentence, religion is, they probably don't know what they're saying. I mean, because it is so tremendously varied, and Jose was mentioning, pre-axial religions and so on, all coexist. Jose will tell you about the city of New York and how many different views are living there. So we can't use the word religion in that generic sense anymore and make sense of it. But I think you can see a shift in the way religious life is lived of the kind that I've described. Okay.
So I'm going to use the word personalization. I don't know if that's all right.
Yeah.
So how does this personalization of religion affect religious freedom? In other words, if everyone has their own idea of what religion is, where does a society draw the line in terms of acceptable religious behavior?
Well, maybe the society ought to draw the line in terms simply of acceptable behavior. You see, that, I think, is the problem of these different conceptions of secularism and laïcité. Is it suddenly very problematic because the reasons why people are doing something unacceptable are religious or not? And when you look at some of the objectionable activities, is it entirely clear they're religious and not cultural? I mean, you get various writers in popular newspapers here who will remain nameless and so on, who attack, note the phenomenon of honor killing, for instance, and say this is a religious phenomenon. Well, is that so, really? I mean, it exists in many Mediterranean countries, some of which are Christian, some of which are Muslim, and so on. And it's very powerfully implanted in those cultures. And it's understood by the people who live in those cultures to be part of their religion because everything becomes for them one. But if you look at Islam, for instance, you won't find Quranic basis for killing your daughter. Okay? So it's something which is lived as partly religious, but it's cultural and so on. And then people make a big fuss about it. Is the motivation religious? Well, you can't even figure that out. You know, you can't honestly, clairvoyantly even decide whether it's one or the other. So maybe what we have to think about is forget religion. Is the behavior acceptable? Killing your daughter is not. Okay? It's indictment and for murder is the ought to be the. But there isn't a specific problem, I want to argue.
My last question is, how is interfaith dialogue affected when the idea of religion varies from society to society? For example, could religious communication between North America, where a personalized view of religion is favored, and South America, where the number of Christian communities is increasing exponentially, be hindered and or enriched by these different views?
Obviously, we see everywhere these interfaith dialogues taking place at all levels. You have religious leaders getting together, the Pope after September 11 bringing leaders into Assisi to pray together, or even Ratzinger now having discussion with Muslim umams, intellectuals, and so on. But of course, you have periods before. You have the period of the convivencia in Spain, in which Judaism, Christianity, and Islam could relatively live together. Then, of course, comes a place of situation of homogeneous, where Jews and Muslims are expelled from Spain in order to create a Catholic kingdom, a Catholic homogeneous nation state. And then you have the beginning of recognition that we have somehow to learn to live together, both at the local level, because precisely the migrations, the global migrations, but also at the global level, because we have become a small village, or at least we are building all these contacts. So the question is, how is this possible at all? And we have the impression that somehow religious people cannot negotiate differences, and that's why there is a greater problem than with other forms of thinking. But if I look at two societies which are extremely pluralistic religiously, the United States, for instance, and India, of course there are problems, but it is not a question that religions cannot recognize each other. There are communal violence in India, but it's not necessarily linked to, actually, again, religious differences. So my sense is that we perhaps make too much of the problem of religions because we assume that religions have absolute claims and they are irrational and have no way of dealing with one another. I think that historically they've shown to be able, especially the most religious people, have been able to communicate with other religious people relatively well. The question is how to create, of course, institutional structures where precisely those things can happen. If religious differences coincide with territorial boundaries and you are going to fight for territory, holy land, then you are going to have very bloody battles. But if religions become deterritorialized and become sort of the way they are becoming, imagine communities of people, then they may be able to, in New York City, Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Christians may be able to live together as neighbors very well without any problem. So the notion of this class of civilizations or class of religions, I don't see as necessary. Now, when these religious identities coincide with territorial claims, with political conflicts, with other material issues, then, of course, you may have an superimposition of boundaries and conflicts that make it very, very difficult.
Hi. Professor Castanova, this branches off of something that you said in a lecture that you gave at McGill last year that really stood out for me.
I changed my mind.
Perhaps. And Professor Taylor, you can comment on this as well, if you like. It was that in order for religious pluralism to flourish, it must do so within a secular space. So then my question is, does that mean that religious pluralism can only flourish within a secular space?
Well, secular, if by secular we mean a relatively neutral space which does not presuppose superiority of one religion over another, that somehow maintains some kind of equal distance and equal respect towards all religions, then yes, but this is something which was done also in imperial regimes. Emperor Ashoka did it, you know, in the Buddhist. And it's very clear that his aim is to create precisely a condition where all the sects, all the groups, can live together. It was not secular in our sense because it was not post-religious. But very clearly, we have throughout history examples precisely of rulers who had to rule over many different religious people and have to come to some form of secularism, some form of neutrality for the sake of precisely let this religious pluralism flourish and maybe be helpful for the realm. So if this happens under rulers that are interested in maintaining peace and order in their empire, the question is obviously we as citizens have an interest in this happening as well. And here, of course, sometimes we have, and something which Charles has emphasized, a tension between our liberal principles of individual rights and our national democratic principles in which we think of homogeneous culture. I mean, our states are simultaneously liberal states that promise equality to individuals qua individuals, but also national democratic states that we the people. And we the people is defined in linguistic terms, cultural terms, national terms. And so the tension between these two things is there. And the question is how to both be able to incorporate into we the people the pluralism, which basically is already there, but it can be let even flourish more.
But this is your topic.
But I think that you can see contemporary Egypt, right? To the extent that there's more violence, Muslim violence on Copts, and to the extent that it looks like it's supported by the government, you're going to, the possibility, which is also growing in other parts of the society, to have real exchange and mutual understanding between these two groups, lessens. I mean, that's all you can say. You can't just say, in some definition of secular, it's got to be a secular state. But the more you have that kind of domination of one over the other, the less you can hope to have this kind of exchange. And the last point Jose made, I think, is very, very important, because I think that's perhaps the biggest challenge we're all facing. We're all You see, the secular, the way I'm understanding it, in laïcité ouverte, centers on the issue of really multiculturalism. Right? Can these very different religious and cultural ways of life and view live together? And it's very important that democracies depend on this notion of the people as a community operating together, discussing together, and so on. So do we have then to redefine what it is that makes us this community? And I think we do. And a lot of the problem in many Western societies is that there's been a very powerful ethnic component in the definition of the national community in Germany. And not so much in France, because the social imaginary is that it wasn't ethnic, but these things become ethnic, even though they creep, ethnicism can creep in, right? And we have this in Quebec, see? The original beneficiary of the nationalism of Québécois here was very much ethnically defined, you know, Québécois de souche, right? But you can't do that and have a really very varied society, I would argue. So there is a struggle to redefine what it is to be Québécois. And the present very striking range of meanings of this term, right? Where somebody would say in the same breath, you know, sure, Québécois, citoyen Québécois. Mais quand on était dans la chambre, il y avait trois gens de Norvège et deux Québécois. See? The same guy will say that, who just made a wonderful statement earlier about everybody's a Québécois. The thing shifts into its ethnic gear, right? The word shifts into its ethnic gear. And that is the sign of a still-to-be-worked-out problem. But I think we're not specific in that. Every modern Western society has to go through this perpetual redefinition of what it is to be a member of that society.
I may only make comment on the comments, because it was interesting. I mean, for me, it was fascinating, the Tahrir Square, when you had on Fridays, while the Muslims were praying, the Christians surrounding them, protecting them from, let's say, the police. And on Sunday, when the Christians were praying, you had the Muslims protecting them. Now, they create their own, if you will, secularity in the process. And it was also, even after the repression and the conflict, you had Muslims siding with the cops, saying and blaming the authorities for having provoked it. So, again, the question is, what are the sources of this kind of secularity? Obviously, we thought that it has to come from above, from the state. If it comes from the state, it will only be a repressive model. So it has to be somehow a mutual recognition from society also.
I'm done for now. Thank you.
So thank you, three. We'll open the floor to general questions of anyone. Frank, should people use the microphones here? Okay. Don't worry about the microphones, then. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm like. I'm certainly approaching this from a different framework, I guess. I'll admit that I haven't read either of your works. So, but I've been talking to a lot of people over the past week about the death of Steve Jobs, and I was. Really quite shocked by the response to his death, and that, like, when I went on the Toronto Star's website, like, the top five stories were about him, and this is on the eve of the Ontario election. And I started to think about, like, the way that, I started to read some of the obituaries, which I thought tended to treat him as a very sort of, almost like a this sort of figure of a prophet. And in terms of the way that he was being praised as somebody who had brought all this sort of progress, it had this, like, this very sort of teleological, almost religious quality to it. You know, the way that Apple products are sort of like enhancing our bodies in all sorts of, like, wonderful ways, and in addition to the fact that the logo for Apple is, you know, is like the, of course the, yeah, right, the symbol for original sin. just made me think, sort of, well, it was kind of a reminder, I guess, of the complex ways in which we're currently, in which secular society is negotiating these, like, historical religious teleologies. And I'm just wondering, first of all, if you think that's a fair assessment. Secondly, if you think it's problematic in any way. And I guess thirdly, if information technology itself has lends itself in particular to these kinds of patterns.
I cannot answer directly, but indirectly, I'm sure you've heard of transhumanism as a movement. Transhumanism, or now it's called Humanity Plus, movement that started in California, and the idea is that we are at a higher stage of, we are going to transcend humanity in the evolutionary sense. And basically through three, there are three versions. One is a kind of a spiritualization of technology. Please believe that technology somehow can give us what religion has promised and could not deliver. Now technology is going to do it. From immortality, living forever, to basically no suffering and perfect happiness, to basically the possibility of really beyond human flourishing, but without having to do any path of salvation, of ascetic, but basically technology can provide us. The other, of course, has to do with the actual genetic transformation of our genetic codes and basically going to a higher stage of... And the other has to do with the whole issue of the brain and nanotechnologies and even uploading our minds to this artificial intelligence that then become much more powerful, and we simply go into a higher form of mind, of nous, in almost in the Teilhardian sense, but without religion. So there is something about this kind of magical and spiritual beliefs in technology which may be related to the way in which Steve Jobs has been appreciated by some people. So I'm not responding directly, but the fact that we have such a movement, let's say, is an interesting aspect of our culture. Again, it may be only a small sect doing it, but it's symbolic of part of our culture. I'm saying this because actually Habermas is coming to spend a week next week at Georgetown. We are going to discuss all these issues on transhumanism and having debates about it. So that's right. Would you like to add something?
Yes, it's very important what Jose said about transhumanism, and I'm very negative about that for a whole lot of reasons. But I see something else possibly in Steve Jobs. People are looking for meaning, right? And that's, of course, a very modern idea, that people are looking for meaning that wouldn't have made sense earlier. You know, people were looking for salvation. They're more definitely described goals of this kind, looking for meaning. And you can see that even if you don't go all the way with the transhuman idea, there is a notion there that he's somehow enhancing the meaning in our lives, right? And it's a double, not even almost contradictory, but it's a double movement. On one hand, these wonderful new, you know, mechanisms, which I never know how to handle and I break down, so I'm the wrong person to talk about this. I have to, you know, take 60 years off my age and I would be able. But they seem to have, seen from the outside, they seem to have capacity, first of all, on one side, to allow us to live very much on our own, because you get an iPad, and you can do, you don't have to phone up your friends anymore to ask about this, or that. You can do it all on your own. But secondly, to link people in these new sets of virtual ways, right? So it has both an individuating and a affiliating sociability dimension to it, which are combined. And these two together excite people. And I think that there is perhaps a great deal too much hope and a great deal too much expectation placed in those. And they have definite limits. But people tend to hype tends to get generated by this. See? I mean, Tahrir Square happens and people say, okay, democracy now. People just hook up and there'll be democracy. I think that those social media are terrific for the overturn. I mean, just think of the difficulties of getting everyone together there to overturn Mubarak, you know, before. But they don't do anything for the aftermath, see? Where there's this long work about changing people's identity and so on. So I think they're definitely overblown. But I can understand what lies behind the hype. I can understand the excitement of people there, you know, waiting for the next Steve Jobs thing and then seeing him as a great prophet.
Hi, thank you. you so much. I've been following both of your writings for many years and been to many of your conference presentations and such. And Dr. Taylor, when you were here at the AAR a couple years ago, you did a little bit of this rethinking secularism, working it out. And you mentioned two models, the post-Enlightenment model and the model of diversity. And the diversity model, you said, required liberty of conscience, equality between all communities, and then of no exclusion of voices. And I think diversity gets paired with secularism a lot when we talk about it. And the word that I always want to interject is tolerance. And I always think of tolerance as very pluralistic and very, you know, a good thing. But, of course, it has a very negative association in the sense that it could be kind of a resignation type of acceptance. I respect you, but I don't, you know, I don't respect you, but I tolerate you sort of thing. So my question is, where does tolerance fit into this discussion of secularism? And should we be supporting it or should we be critiquing it?
You can't do either one simply because, well, let's rapidly run through the argument. And people argue that tolerance is inferior to other forms, other bases of coexistence, because, as you say, it implies, well, it's pretty disgusting what you're doing there, but I'll control myself and not stop you. So this conflicts with the basis that we understand of diversity on coming from rights regimes, where everybody has a right to speak their mind. So if you say, I'm going to tolerate you, they say, what do you mean tolerate me? I have a right. It doesn't depend on you. On the other hand, as some people have pointed out, like Ira Katznelson and others, there are cases where the alternative to tolerance is not this happier kind of coexistence, but intolerance. And even you have very liberal multicultural societies that break out in attacks of intolerance for, you know, just, again, the aftermath of Pushout Taylor. We won't go into that in detail, but you can see that happening, right? So you could never say, tolerance, forget it, it belongs to an earlier era. But you can say, we have claim here in our rights regimes to have found a basis for the coexistence of difference in respect and equality, which is beyond tolerance. It's transcended tolerance. And then we look back. This is interesting. We were talking about Ashok and Akbar and these convivencia and so on. These earlier modes also were trying to get beyond tolerance. You know? They were trying to, you know, positive value of.
As far as interfaith dialogue is concerned, do you think that the communication between two persons of different, faiths or creeds has parallels with the communication between a religious person and a person who would call themselves as, you know, pertaining to a more secular tradition? Like, or do you think that it's just two completely different paradigms of communication between people?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, what's interesting to do, what's interesting, what's moving, what I think is very important to do is, the first phase is always people get together and say, you know, we want to be friends and we don't want to insult each other and so on. But if people really sit down and try to explain to the other why their position, whatever it is something that really moves them, something they find, you know, really important, really inspires them, something can occur in that, over that boundary. And it can be with people who believe and are atheists and believe, or between people who believe different things, or between different kinds of Nietzsche and then a follower of John Stuart Mill and so on. They have to talk to each other. Now, I think there's something very interesting going on in our world, that a lot of that is happening, and that a lot of people of very different positions, including orthodox religious belief, but also rather uptight Enlightenment beliefs, that used to have no place for that. I mean, why talk to these stupid religious people? Why talk to these atheists? Or why talk to these Muslims? Are beginning to thaw out on that. And that's, I think there's something more than just change. There's a change in the whole, this part of the surrounding understanding that I was talking about earlier, the surrounding understanding of the place of the spiritual and the religious has made that much more acceptable and important. And I think, we could go on for hours, and I won't do, but it's something tremendously valuable arises out of that. And also possibility of getting beyond some really, you know, I mean, the kind of things that make toleration necessary, because you're just, you know, these things melt when you really talk to people who, I mean, you know, not point scoring anymore. But
there are different models. I mean, one of the first ecumenical, I mean, with the great theologian of ecumenical dialogue, one of them was Hans King. He began the Catholic-Protestant dialogue, then it was the Christian-Jewish dialogue, and then all the world religions. But his model is this of a theological dialogue to see what do they have in common, to find a common ground in our theologies. It's a very liberal position. Conservatives hate this type of interfaith dialogue. They say we can never, let's say, agree on our theological principles, but we can recognize each other as persons. So Hans King could have dialogue with liberals of every other world religion, but could not have dialogue with his own pope, right? And the pope perhaps cannot have dialogue with Hans King, but can bring religious leaders from all religions to pray together. Again, so you have these different meanings of what interfaith. Now you have somebody like Mother Teresa that will say, I love all religions, but I am in love with my own religion. And again, this is a very different type of, let's say, dialogue incorporating this recognition, right?
So, it seems to me that religions just, you know, there are some universals across all religions that are, you know, very obvious that, you know, they share a lot in common, although, you know, the language with which they describe it is different from case to case, whereas it seems to me that there is no such thing in common between, you know, religion as such and secularity as such.
I wouldn't agree with that. Yeah, I think you have a lot of... You have even secular people that will say, I'm religiously unmusical. They will have, I mean, you know, they have the possibility of having this kind of dialogue. So I would disagree. The interesting question is when you have the possibility of, let's say, Christian Buddhist or Christian Hindu, somebody like Panikkar, Raymond Panikkar, right, that sees the need to translate Christianity into Hinduism and Hinduism into Christianity, but you don't begin with the notion that everything is the same, there is a universal, and we can find this common universal. But really, it's a very difficult task of translation. You have to recognize it. But
I mean, just to challenge your position, take someone like Nietzsche. Do you not find the writings of Nietzsche that this position really inspires him at certain points? When he writes about, there is the will to power and nothing else. He's on a high. Okay, now, when you read Camus, he's on a high. Now, what is that high about? And that's what's interesting to understand. That's what exchange can really be about. As against, you know, and we're in our bunker, you're in your bunker, we're going to take pot shots at your position and show it up. No. Just why are you excited by this? And sometimes they answer it out of their books. That's the great thing about these books.
Okay, thank you. My question is unfortunately not well formulated. There's several jammed in here, so it's just really to mention a couple of words, so without trying to formulate in a coherent way. The problem of evil, I haven't heard, but it's latent in here with the normative and the nomological. The problem of shifting the framework so as to be more in touch with what's going on the ground. And sometimes the framework isn't representing what's going on the ground, the terrific complexity. And is that complexity disintegrating to such an extent that what we'll get is just the entropy? And the third part of this, if I had more time, I guess I could sew them together. I read a lot of women's stuff, and what I see is a real concern with the... This is all very lofty. And I see a concern with family and hunger and pain and suffering and war in a much more nitty-gritty level. And it seems to me that maybe using a phrase I love from the sources of the self, the sources of normativity, maybe we're heading toward this incredible disintegration, this incredible suffering in the world, towards a source of response to the horror And I don't hear that in these questions and in this discussion. It seems to me that somehow there's something gritty that isn't being discussed here.
Yeah, and I think that's very, very important what you're saying, because I think that we're seeing, this is what I was groping for a minute ago when I said something is changing in the zeitgeist, I almost say, right? And what you're seeing now is that people faced with some of the really horrible things happening in the world, and they may be working through NGOs to do this, let's say. And some NGOs are confessional, but some aren't. And when even the NGOs that are confessional are beginning more and more to work with each other. So what you get is a kind of coming together of people from these very different standpoints, because they're really moved and worried by these events and these developments, and they want to work on them. So, yeah, and I wanted to, the second thing you were talking about, it seems to me that that is relevant to this, that there two things are going on at once and they head in different directions. There are more different positions out there, more different variants of belief and unbelief out there. So in that way, we're fragmenting. But in another way, some people are coming together on these. And I like to mention Habermas here, because one of the reasons for Habermas's switch to this post-secular thing is he sees, and this is something I think is very, very worrying, decline in our sense of solidarity in democracies, right? And he sees that the possible sources, to use my phrase, for fighting against that are varied. And what we really need is to bring people together who, for different reasons, find this draining away of solidarity very, very worrying. You know, the American debate on health care is just horrifying to me. I mean, people said 40 million people don't. Some people said, so what? You know, Ayn Rand doesn't. So this is, and we could go that way. I can feel that we could go that way. So there again, a strange thing is happening, that the sources for fighting that are plural, but they're not standing saying, we're the only one, you guys shut up. Sometimes they do, but in many cases what you have is people coming together on this, right? And I think that's a very important part of the picture. And that's perhaps part of why the whole interfaith situation has changed. I think it's changed in our world.
Thank you. I wonder if I could just ask you to clarify a bit on your history of secularism that you presented. How is it that at the exact same historical moment when a sense of moral universalism gains widespread currency in Western Europe, a sense that the universe of our moral sentiment and a idea of human flourishing should be extended to all people regardless of their religious communities. How is it that that moment of universalism is also the moment when a sense of personal individual authenticity seems to gain such currency as well? There doesn't have to be a tension necessarily, I'm sure, between a sense of individual authenticity on the one hand and also this belief, this conviction that we should all, wherever we are, organize our political institutions to promote a particular kind of human flourishing. But there could be this conflict, and I'm sure we see it in the record. How do you reconcile those two visions of that kind of axial moment in the 17th and 18th centuries?
I don't know what you're suggesting. Is it that they should be logically in conflict with each other? I don't. Or are you suggesting that they logically complement each other? Do you think there should be a conflict?
It seems like there might have been, because I can imagine someone like John Stuart Mill might think that we need to, wherever you are, it is whether you're in India or whether you're in England, it's important to organize your institutions.
Yeah.
And everybody has their own individual way of being flourishing. There's this tension that seems to arise.
It can arise, but I would actually reverse those two. John Stuart Mill doesn't come off well in comparison with Burke on that issue. I mean, Burke actually impeached Warren Hastings because he was exploiting and wreaking havoc in this other culture. And John Stuart Mill famously said that the Indians need a period of rule, colonial rule, to shape up so that they can be democratic. See? So I think that many things are going on at the same time. And certainly this tremendous outburst of, if you like, I mean, breaking through certain barriers to a more universal view is happening in the late 18th century, most notable in the anti-slavery, which is perhaps more powerfully espoused by evangelicals and others, but right? That's going on. And in a less, as it were, important, I mean, noticeable way, the whole authenticity thing is going on. People like Herder, who are major figures in the second, were very much against slavery, incidentally, because precisely of the sense of the, each culture having its own rights, right? So more like Burke. What also is going on is an exacerbation, what Jose was talking about earlier, of the European sense that we are way ahead of everybody else. I mean, it's not an accident that somebody, that Burke is earlier than John Stuart Mill. History is not unilateral progress, very clearly. If we go back to the Jesuits in the 16th century, 17th century, and we move up, the kind of apex of this blind sense of ethnocentric superiority is the latter half of the 19th and first half of the 20th century. And now we're kind of gradually kicking ourselves out of that. So there are movements crossing here in different directions. There are a sense that everybody has a right to be and every culture has a right to be, going along with this growing sense that we Westerners understand it all. And in a way, that's what's happening today, right? I mean, there are certain elements in Western democratic society that want to invade everybody and make them democratic. I mean, we have the answer to freedom, right? I mean, so we're not over that yet, but all these things are happening together in history. It's never logical.
Only briefly, I don't see that much the tension between universalism and individualism or authenticity. I think that they always go together. In every period where you have kind of these universalist expansions, you also have individualist expansions. For me, the more interesting thing is the particularity of every universalism. And what makes for me the Axial Age so interesting is that wherever in human history universalism emerges, it emerges as plural. And yes, Confucian is a universalist ethic, and Buddha is a universalist, and Socrates and the prophets, all of them some kind of, but they are very different types of universalisms. And we are, I think, struggling with that when we talk of cosmopolitanism. The notion that there is one form of cosmopolitanism that we should all embrace. We simply are competing models of cosmopolitanism, and every cosmopolitanism is very particular. So it is this recognition that universalism is always going to come in very particular shapes and forms. And the assumption that our universalism is the truly universal and the others are particularistic is the problem. So the recognition of the plurality of universalism, if you wish, because each of them is particular, I think that this is what we are now facing as a recognition today in our global moment.
I think in the course of this symposium, we've talked a lot about historical development and so on, and particularly in relation to these outmoded models of historical development from a religious society to a secular society. And I suppose that we've talked about the disillusion of the dream that the secular age is the final age and the fulfillment of history and so on. But the question I should like to ask is essentially, do you see history as being endowed with a dynamism or a trajectory? What would that dynamism be, and what does secularization have to do with that?
Obviously, we are, to a certain extent, from the point of view of our teleological views of modernity, at the end of utopia. And this is obviously troubling because we are facing very serious problems and we don't have any ideas how to solve them. But maybe it's good that we don't have the enthusiasm because enthusiasm can be also very problematic. My own view of things, and it's very particular, is that we are moving from a philosophy of history, of time, unidirectional, to a philosophy of a space, of simply coming to learn to live together and recognizing each other. So we simply... whichever project we have, from now on is going to have to be a project of global humanity in which all parts of humanity will have to somehow participate in this project. It's not anymore we know what the future of history is and we are going to show it to the rest of the world. So we are beyond this stage, and so we are really facing a situation in which no part of humanity can tell the rest we are going to go in this direction. And it's in this respect a kind of a puzzling moment, because we are facing very, very serious global issues that we will have to grapple together. And we do not have visions at all. I mean, we see with the economic crisis that nobody knows what to do with anything. And so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly can't buy any of these earlier teleological views. If you look at them and how they crack up, you can see a pattern that people think that if we only move more in this direction, for instance, more democratization or better human rights regimes, things will get better and better and better, right? And then we find out that, well, you've left out something. I mean, for instance, you've left out all the people who are left out of the globalization, who are rebelling against that. Or it's a very ethnocentric view of how everyone's going to live together, which is, and that causes a reaction. Or, I mean, the recent riots in London and other centers in England, right? How does one explain that? Or, you know, the way in which the 2008, et cetera. I could go on and on and on. So history is a kind of, from one point of view, a series of qui pro quo, of misunderstandings, right? People think that if we head in this direction, everything's going to go okay, and then a new set of issues, a new set of dangers arises, and then they think if we solve those, everything's going to be okay, and then a new set arises. I don't see any point at which history is going to say, that's it, I've given you all the problems, you solved this last one, and, you know, first class degree, no.
As a member of the Baha'i community, I was very encouraged to see recently your statement condemning the persecution of my people in Iran, specifically the closure of the BIHE, the Baha'i Institute of Higher Education. And I was very intrigued by your particular statement on the subject, which seemed to appeal to Muslim scripture as a sort of means to sort of chastise this grievous oppression. You said there's no compulsion in religion, which is, I believe, a Quranic quote. And I was wondering, if we want to enforce a standard of justice across the world, obviously we don't want to just enforce our own Western sense of this justice. And I think what you did was very good, because it sort of went into the own tradition of that particular culture to sort of engage that injustice. And I was wondering if this is a model that, you know, you think we could adopt globally to try and make sure that there is a standard of justice which we can uphold as a people.
Definitely, one of the things we should be trying to work on, that's going wrong, and there'll be other things after, but one of the things we should try to work on is to get an understanding whereby whatever the human rights regime we end up agreeing on, there are really solid bases for this in every tradition. And that can be done, but it is very often not done, because it's thought, you know, that the existing philosophical foundations that we might have in John Stuart Mill or Locke are perfectly sufficient. Well, they may be perfectly sufficient for us, but they aren't such as really carry conviction elsewhere. So we need to have this kind of debate. And to be fair, the, you know, UN 1948 Universal Declaration was the fruit of a debate which is much more than Western at that time, and was trying to get, as it were, a statement that could emerge from all these. But that's something that, you know, needs to be complemented with further steps in this direction. That should be definitely one of our important aims.
It seems that if the fundamental question is how people of all religions can live together peacefully and respectfully, then it's somewhat dependent on a separation of religion from the public sphere and the civic sphere, because if religion is necessary to legitimize political actors or a political system, as we have seen in the United States. I mean, it's virtually impossible to be nominated to any of the major parties for president of the United States without a profession of faith, specifically a Christian one. If we can't arrive at a point where that profession of faith is unnecessary in the civic realm, then it doesn't seem that we can ever really come to a point where all religions are equally represented and equally respected. So how does that square with the idea that secularism is necessarily a universal answer to cooperation.
How does it square with the idea that
The vision, I guess, that secularism, as we know it now, isn't the, I suppose, the answer to the question of how to cooperate with one another?
Well, I think that secularism, in the way I'm trying to define it, is one of the important answers. And what you're pointing to is a case in the American situation whereby there is a, they don't quite reach that point, right? No society quite does reach that point. They did do a wonderful thing in the United States by electing somebody who was African American, which we all thought was impossible beforehand. But they still have some way to go on that. And every single Western society has, you know, some reservations about who can be really president or prime minister. There in Europe, there are a lot worse ones and a lot more ethnically related ones. But we just have to keep on working on that. There's no other answer to them.
Your very example shows that the issue is not so much religion or not religion, because obviously all politicians in America are Christians, but this doesn't make them able to work together at all. It's the most dysfunctional system I've known. I mean, politically, so the question is, obviously, whether it is due to presidentialism as a system or whether it is due to the political culture of the United States. We could argue about it. First, if you ask me, are you a religious citizen or a secular citizen? Well, I'm both. I mean, if you tell me, well, to be a secular citizen, you have to leave your religion there. But what if religion is what moves me to solidarity, to, you know, think of the common good? Why should I leave it outside if this is precisely what makes me go beyond my own self-interest to become interested in the common good? So now, if you are saying, yeah, but when you come to the public sphere, you should not come as Christian, fine. That's fine. So that's fine that we recognize each other as fellow citizens in the public sphere. But what brings us to the public sphere may be precisely religious impulse. So the notion that somehow religion is a problem, I simply don't see it. Now, which kind of religions and how it works? For me, the notion that somehow secular people are more rational than religious people and therefore they are the ones that should be in the public sphere. I mean, I don't see it empirically. As a socialist, I don't see that secular people, when they do politics, are more rational than religious people when they do politics. I don't see the difference at all. So if we are talking about principles, then we can agree or disagree. But empirically, in terms of trying to understand the problem, I don't think the problem is that people are religious or not religious. It's a different kind of issue.
Just one last question.
The question I'd like to ask, is it a condition of the continuation of the utility of this notion of secularity or laïcité, that there be something beyond, outside, or above history?
No, I mean, how could that be a necessity? I mean, this is an attempt to find a formula for people living together. Some of whom do think something is beyond history, and some of whom don't think something is beyond history. So,
the question is, how is it meaningful in the end to speak of secularity if it doesn't have a reference to the metaphysical?
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Well, maybe it isn't, but maybe we're stuck with the word because it's important. You know, if I could rewrite Western history. I'm working on it. Rewrite the whole, not just the historiography, but what happened, right? I would maybe not, for instance, have the word laïcité in the prominent position that it has, because it carries all sorts of, baggage of anti-clericalism. And that's one of the things we're fighting in Quebec around this, right? But, you know, at a certain point, if you're in political, you're operating politically, right, like writing a report for the government, you have to think, if I invent a whole new vocabulary, no one will know what I'm talking about. We won't engage with the issues, right? So you say, okay, we'll call it. So we call it laïcité ouverte. We just make the little tweak there. But you're right. I mean, it doesn't necessarily. I could express this a lot easier if I had a totally different vocabulary. But I got to convince 7 million. Yeah.
Yeah. On that note, we've come to the end of this event. I'd like to begin by thanking all of you for your participation in this conversation, especially our three student panelists, and most especially Professor Casanova and Professor Taylor for your thoughts and time and all that you've said this afternoon. Thank you. Would you join me in thanking them?